This is Live and Local. It's your connection to local performances, including performances by the Illinois Symphony Orchestra in Bloomington and Springfield this weekend, Friday and Saturday, respectively. Their guest artist, well, they actually have two, guest conductor Andrew Sewell, who's making his second appearance with the orchestra as he vies to become the new music director of the orchestra, along with, I think it was four other candidates. Vadim Gluzman, I always get the L in the wrong place. Vadim Gluzman is the violin soloist. He'll be playing the violin concerto of Johannes Brahms on those concerts, and I'll talk with him later in the hour. First up, though, we are going to be talking with conductor Eugene Power, who is giving a concert of music for chamber orchestra at McKinley Presbyterian Church in Champaign Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock. And his particular station in life sort of brings a bunch of questions that we will explore as he's currently a graduate student at the University of Illinois. One of the pieces on his program is the last of Haydn's 104 symphonies, of which this is the opening. After the grand opening, we get into the lively allegro movement of the beginning of the Symphony number 104 by Joseph Haydn, often nicknamed the London Symphony. Not sure why, since it's one of a bunch of symphonies that he wrote for the City of London, but it happens to be the last of those and also the last of his symphonies, period. In a performance in this recording of by the orchestra of the 18th century, on instruments of the period, or copies of instruments of the period, conducted by Franz Bruggen. And you can hear it performed live on a concert of music for chamber orchestra Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at McKinley Presbyterian Church in Champaign. This orchestra has no name because it's a pickup orchestra, essentially. It's the sort of orchestra that graduate students in conducting have to get together every once in a while if they want things to conduct, things being what they are in graduate school. And the conductor will be Eugene Power, who is a doctoral student in orchestral conducting at the University of Illinois. In fact, he is the first doctoral student in orchestral conducting at the University of Illinois for rather curious reasons. They've never had a doctoral program in that field before. You can only get a master's degree, as I did many years, well, 20 years ago, almost 20 years ago. Gene Power's with me here on Live and Local to talk about the vagaries of this situation that he's in. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And so I keep talking about this situation. The situation is that you're somebody who's been out in the world and conducting in some way or another, teaching,
right,
and are back in school, which is, what, your second or third year?
This is my second year here in Champaign-Urbana.
So you did your master's degree?
Here, actually.
Finished that last year.
Actually, yeah, I finished it this year, and I'm kind of overlapping degrees right now, starting my coursework, and I don't officially graduate with the master's until May.
Okay, so you're finishing up one, getting a start on the other.
Exactly.
And the dilemma is that the university doesn't really have an orchestra you can regularly conduct. You can say, this is my orchestra.
Right.
And there's not that many programs in the country that offer that to doctoral students.
Yeah, that's correct. We, the students in the conducting studio, actually get quite a few opportunities to conduct the university ensembles. And actually, one of the assistants conducts the Illini String Orchestra. And that's her job. And I'll actually be doing that next year as my assistantship with the university. But for the meantime, if I want to do a full program of works, putting together my own orchestra is the option, and so that's what I've done with this group.
And I indicated you've been out in the world, so to speak, before. Yeah. What were you doing before you came back to school?
Well, for 8 years between when I graduated with my bachelor's degree and before arriving here, I was a high school, middle school band director, and I also was a youth orchestra director in Wisconsin, and I was the assistant conductor for an orchestra in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. So I did primarily teaching, but then did other conducting duties as well. And I was kind of a freelance musician around the Wisconsin, Minnesota area as well.
On what instrument or instruments?
Well, I'm a woodwind player, so I play clarinet, saxophone, and flute. Those are my primary instruments.
They often go together if somebody plays jazz.
Are you a
jazz musician?
I started out as a jazz musician, actually. And my original intent when I began studying music was to be a studio musician. And I spent hours and hours and hours in the practice room and learned those different instruments and really studied them. And then I got really interested in conducting and orchestral literature. And so I decided to kind of focus there.
Well, I was going to say, what diverted you? And I guess conducting has diverted more, diverted quite a few otherwise unsuspecting people, you know, who didn't necessarily think that's what they want to do. And
right.
I mean, why would you make that choice given the difficulty of finding gigs in that field?
That's a very interesting question. I guess at first I didn't realize the difficulty. I kind of assumed, oh, you just be a conductor. Okay, this is, you know, you get to conduct music, but it's not that easy. But I think our conducting studio went to Indianapolis earlier this year, and we saw Larry Ratcliffe, who's the conductor of orchestras at Rice University. He also conducts the Rhode Island Philharmonic, and he's a fantastic musician, fantastic conductor, and a wonderful teacher. And he kind of told us all that, you know, it's a really hard field to be in, but if you love it just enough to get you through the times when you are feeling like, why did I do this? If you love it just enough to open the page of the score and take a look at it, it really helps you to get through. So even though it's tough, it still kind of is, you know, it's good to dream and think big and do things like put your own orchestra together and play music that you want to perform and take as many opportunities as you can. So a lot of the conductors that I know and have talked to, they don't have a job. They have five jobs, and they you know, go from one thing to the next. And you just kind of do it because you love it, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's the idea, isn't
yeah.
it? I mean, I'm an example of somebody who of sort of a mix of some of the things you just talked about.
Yeah.
Where I remember standing in front of one of my former conducting teachers, and the way he worked, I would just stand across his desk and I would conduct in silence, mm-hmm. you know, which mm-hmm. was a very weird experience,
yeah.
frankly. And there was one day where I just sort of dropped my arms and hung my head, and I said, I just don't think I can do this.
Yeah.
And he sat down and gave me this 15-minute pep talk to say why, from his point of view, he thought I could. And but I certainly ran into all the difficulties of trying to find a job with only a master's degree
yeah.
and not any real experience. And so here I am piecing together four different gigs.
Right.
I've got three places where I conduct, and I mm-hmm. do this radio program and so on. And I've often wondered... you know, is this it? Is this my personal dead end as far as that goes?
Mm-hmm.
And for many people, you get to a point and you say, that's where you are. Or you decide that you're going to teach school
mm-hmm.
and that's where you are. That may or may not have been what you set out to be.
Right.
You happen to be in a program where you have a wonderful teacher, a wonderful conductor, Donald Schleicher, who's a friend of Larry Ratcliffe's, I
right.
understand.
Yes, yep.
And this is a program that has sent people out to get who have gotten jobs.
Right, right.
Which is to their personal credit, but I have to assume it's also to the credit of the program here and to Professor Schleicher.
Well, it's a wonderful environment, and he's a fantastic teacher. He really does a fantastic job in training us to be good musicians, to use our musicianship and to rehearse well and listen, use our ears, but then also to be practical and to really, you know, sort of be professional. And he kind of gives us all of the package of what a conductor is, and he has a lot of advice for us, and he's a fantastic conductor and a fantastic teacher. So I feel very privileged to be here, because he's as far as conducting teachers go, I don't think I've ever seen anybody that's able to diagnose, well, this is why this isn't working for you, and so maybe you should try this, and really just brings out the best in all of us, which is really fantastic. It's just a wonderful place to be in the environment that the studio, the conductors, the other conductors, and I are in with each other is also very wonderful, because we're all supportive of each other, and we help each other out, and we get together outside of class and we discuss things, and there's a real effort among everybody to make it a great educational experience for all of us.
You know, I'm glad to hear you say that. I mean, I've found that to be true, not only in the program when I was in the program here with a different teacher, where there were just two of us at the time, mm-hmm. but also when I've gone out and gone to workshops and other places. I suspect many people, not least orchestral musicians, might be surprised to know how collegial conductors are
yeah.
with each other, because, you know, you have this stereotype that the conductor is just a walking ego.
Right.
Who wants to tell you how to do everything. Uh-huh. But I've never found a more supportive bunch of people, frankly.
Well, I think part of it has to do with the fact that we are kind of isolated as conductors. Conductors are not, you know, rank and file musicians. We don't, we really can't be friends with the musicians, because if you are, you know, buddies with one person, that might make somebody else think that you're playing favorites in an ensemble or something like that. And so it does become sort of you have to be professional, you have to be respectful, and you have to be friendly, but you, at the same time, you don't have, the musicians are not colleagues in the same way that your other conductors are. And all of the other conductors that I've worked with in workshops and festivals and here, we all kind of, when we get together, we can talk about the specifics of what conducting is. And it's just like if, you know, you get a bunch of violinists together that are able to talk about their profession and the challenges in their profession. It's the same way with conductors, but there's more musicians in the orchestra than there are conductors. So it is a kind of a lonely life in a way. And so it's nice to get around other people that are conductors and to be able to talk shop, I guess, is a good way to put it.
And maybe just to talk to somebody, because you know, you're
right.
in an orchestra rehearsal and
right.
they don't talk.
Right.
I remember years ago when I used to conduct some choirs in Chicago, I was friends with a lot of these singers who mm-hmm. I sang with.
Yeah.
And then if I got them together, sort of what you've done, where you get a pickup group together, people mm-hmm. you know, and all of a sudden in the conducting situation, the rehearsal situation, nobody would talk to me anymore.
Yeah.
For the space of that time, you know, yeah. I just feel all by myself, and these people otherwise mm-hmm. normally would talk to. And then the rehearsal's over, you see them somewhere else, and they, hey, you know, then you go back to being friends. It's a really weird dynamic that would be interesting to explore in a different context. Mm-hmm. Your concert on Sunday, and let's remind yeah. listeners that we're talking with Gene Power, who's going to be conducting a pickup orchestra, chamber orchestra, for a concert Sunday afternoon in Champaign. What did you have to go through to get an orchestra together?
Well, you meet a lot of people being in graduate school in the conducting program through who you work with. And so I just asked people that I know. And it's a little bit different being a grad student and being sort of on the same students with other students and other people that you see. So this is a little bit easier entry point, whereas I'm not contracting a bunch of professional musicians to do this. It's a lot of students and some community players that also have association with the university. So it's a really, it's a mixture of people that I knew and that people that knew people that I asked through them. And so I kind of just sent out emails and talked to people in person. And I asked a lot of people. Probably there's 35 people in the ensemble, and I probably asked about 70 people if they would play. And so there's a lot of people that weren't able to do it because of other conflicts. So it was a lot of work just getting that organized. And then I had to book the space for the performance and everything like that at McKinley Church. And so basically to do a project like this, it's you're not only the conductor, the music director, but you're also the personnel manager. You're the stage crew. And also you supply food for the musicians. At the
and you're rehearsals. The business manager.
And you're the business manager. Yeah. So it's a full job.
The conductors don't normally supply food, but this
That's
is
correct.
In lieu of payment.
Right, right. It's amazing what you can do when you tell people you're going to feed them, and they will just show up.
I was going to ask, what's the incentive other than food for people to do something like this? I mean, they've got other things to do.
Well, I think that a lot of people know. I mean, one of the great things about students, all of us together, is that we all help each other out. You know, I just played for a colleague of mine in a pit orchestra for a musical over spring break for the producers.
Which was great, by the way.
Oh,
yeah. I saw that on Saturday night.
Thanks.
It was wonderful.
Yeah,
the orchestra sounded terrific.
It was a fun show to play. And he asked me to play, and I said, sure, I'll do it, because I think that the idea is that, you know, you kind of build karma by helping other people out, and that hopefully sometime in the future they will be able to help you out in return. So
and he's playing on your concert.
He is playing on my concert, actually. And there's other people that just want to play more repertoire. It's kind of interesting, actually. The wind players in these situations often don't get a chance to play some of the standard orchestral repertoire because it's not part of the cycle of concerts when they are here at school. So any chance they can get to practice playing in an ensemble before they go out and actually audition for jobs, they really like to do that. String players, same thing, just to get a chance to play more repertoire. There's a mixture of different reasons, but I think everybody kind of understands what it's like to, I'm giving a recital or I'm putting on a concert, can you help me out? And I think that the musicians at this school are really great about being able to be helpful.
Well, we played one of the standard chamber orchestra pieces to open this conversation in Haydn's 104th Symphony. You'll be doing another standard orchestra piece to close the concert in Beethoven's First Symphony,
right.
You know, going from the last to the first. Did you have that in mind, by the way?
Actually, I did.
Yeah.
I kind of thought it would be interesting to hear 1795, Haydn's Last Symphony, and Beethoven's 1800, First Symphony. And when you study them side by side and compare them, it's quite interesting.
So actually, it's an educational experience for yourself in more ways than one.
Absolutely.
And then you have this piece in the middle that really isn't anybody's standard repertory. I mean, it hardly ever gets played.
Yeah.
I don't think. Mm-hmm. And not recorded very often, but I actually did this, I think, on a recital myself one time, mm-hmm. probably in the same situation you're doing it, which is the Siegfried Idyll of Richard Wagner, which I think was written as a birthday present,
right,
for his not yet wife,
right.
A sordid story.
Yes,
right there.
Yeah. Anytime you talk about Wagner, there's some kind of drama. Yeah, it's a beautiful piece. It's sort of a birthday present. It was premiered on Christmas Day, and it really kind of, you think about Wagner, there's a lot of grand operatic moments that come to mind, but this piece is really, I find, very soulful and very sort of expressing a tender side of Wagner that he just kind of poured into this kind of personal symphonic portrait for his wife and also for his little baby Siegfried.
So even people that have come down to us as sort of bad people have good sides too.
I guess, yeah, that's...
I don't think anybody ever laid claim that Richard Wagner was any sort of saint, but here's some beautiful music that he wrote. Here's the opening of the Siegfried Idyll. This is a performance by the Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam, led by Bernard Haitink, and you can hear it played by an ensemble conducted by Gene Power Sunday afternoon in Champaign. This is Live and Local. That's a little bit of the Siegfried Idyll by Richard Wagner, drawn from themes from his Ring cycle of operas and put into this 18-minute love letter, essentially, to wife and child. The Concertgebouw Orchestra, led by Bernhard Haitink, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9, and Eugene Power will conduct that piece with a much smaller ensemble of musicians from the University of Illinois and the surrounding community Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at McKinley Presbyterian Church in Champaign. A free concert?
Free concert, yes.
Free concert. Hey, that makes it even better. Support for our show today comes in part from Docha, presenting the 2012 Docha Festival, featuring chamber music events and young people's concerts March 30th through April 3rd at the Orpheum Theater in downtown Champaign. A complete list of festival performances is at docha.org. That's docha.org. And we'll be having musicians from the festival give preview later on this week. You can see villages, castles, and manors from Masterpiece and Mystery and more in England and Wales for 14 days beginning September 27th. If American history appeals, board WYLL's Civil War train. Private vintage train cars leaving for the southern battlefields with historian Anthony Pitch September 7th. Information is at will.illinois.edu/willtravel or call 217-333-7300. Gene, we have just a few minutes left. You mentioned how you decided to have Haydn's Last Symphony and Beethoven's First Symphony coming so few, such a small number of years apart, which I didn't think I had quite really given much thought to. What are other considerations that you took into account when deciding what kind of a program would you do on this concert, since you knew you probably wouldn't have a really large ensemble, but also you don't have all that many full programs to conduct while you're here.
Right.
You had all these pieces out there. How do you narrow it down? How do you narrow it down?
Well, part of it is based on, honestly, logistics. When you look at when I decided to do, I wanted to do Haydn first. I thought, okay, that's my anchor of the program. And then I started thinking about repertoire that would encompass just the musicians in the Haydn symphony. So pairs of winds, one, you know, a timpani player, and then strings. And it could be with that sort of those parameters, then I started looking at other pieces. And I actually was toying around with doing some more contemporary stuff and then finishing with Haydn, or opening with a Mozart overture and then doing a couple of shorter contemporary pieces and then doing Haydn as my closer. And what ended up happening, honestly, was a cost thing. I wanted to do the Stravinsky concerto in E-flat, Dumbarton Oaks, for a small chamber orchestra, which would have involved even less strings. And it ended up costing about $300 to rent the music. And I said, well, I'm in graduate school. So yeah. I went ahead and picked the Wagner, thinking that it would be a nice contrast to the Haydn. And then I also had played around with this idea of doing the Beethoven First Symphony and the Last Symphony of Haydn on a program, just to kind of comparison contrast. And so I thought, well, okay, those will be my two outside pieces, and then the middle piece will contrast with the Wagner. So that's kind of was my thought process as I chose the concert.
Well, it's a nice program, and people can enjoy it for free Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock, McKinley Presbyterian Church, which is at the corner of 5th and John Streets in Champaign, right off of Campus Town. There's plenty of parking in parking garages right nearby. 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon. And Eugene Power, a doctoral student at the University of Illinois in the conducting program and conductor for this concert. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for putting together this afternoon of masterworks, as you're calling it.
Great. Well, thanks for having me.
Here's a bit of the final movement of the First Symphony of Beethoven. This is a performance by the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, led by Nikolaus Harnoncourt. It's a little bit of the rather large violin concerto by Johannes Brahms in a recording getting almost dated now these days, by violinist Shlomo Mintz with the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Claudio Abbado. And I played this particular recording as sort of an introduction to my next guest here on Live and Local, who is going to be playing that piece with the Illinois Symphony Orchestra in Bloomington and Springfield on Friday and Saturday, respectively. His name is Vadim Gluzman, and he'll be playing with the symphony under the with guest conductor Andrew Sewell, and joining us right now. Thanks very much for joining us on the show.
My pleasure.
I hadn't realized that you live at least part-time so close to us. We're catching you up in Chicago right now.
That's right. I have a residence in Chicago, so I will be driving to Springfield.
That's a nice thing to be able to do. But the rest of the time you make your home in Israel?
Yes, indeed.
And that was an important change for you when you were all of about 17, I think.
That's right. That was the time when my family repatriated from what was still Soviet Union, not for long, to Israel, and that's where home is, really.
And why was that such an important move for you, personally and musically?
Well, there are many, many levels to it. Everyone is born, or almost everyone is born at home, more or less. Russian Jews weren't. It just so happened. And we were never helped to feel at home. Quite the contrary. And then when the moment was ripe and the doors or walls were no longer there, it was the most natural reaction that over a million of ex-Soviet Jews came to Israel in a span of little over a year. And mind you, Israel is much smaller than Illinois.
Yeah.
So that's in short the answer. I mean, French people live in France, and Jewish people live in Israel. So it was an extraordinary thing to not only to have home, but to experience finding it. It's something I can't really describe, but it becomes even more dear to you, in a way, because you can't possibly take it for granted.
And what about the musical side of things? How has it been an important musical home for you?
Well, this is comparable to a horse that all its life runs with these shades on its eyes. And then suddenly these shades are taken away and the horse gets to experience the world. We were brought up in an extraordinarily secluded musical environment. Good or bad is not even a consideration. There were many positive sides. I don't want to take anything away. But we were cut off from the entire world. We were cut off from all the developments that have been happening forever, and we had absolutely no idea. In fact, I think it was done on purpose. And then I come to Israel and I get to experience chamber music. I meet Isaac Stern, who in the first hour that he spent with me, which was in 1990, I just made my way to Jerusalem Music Center and said, I want to play for you. I was lucky that he had the time. He in this hour he basically showed me that there is something 180 degrees away from where I am, and there is something actually very beautiful. And it was basically like learning to breathe all over again. It was absolutely extraordinary, and I can tell you one thing: I don't want ever to go back.
Back to what is what that's was then and is now the Ukraine.
Oh no! Mm-hmm. I don't feel any political or geographical, but I don't want to ever go back to not breathing.
Ah, well, yeah, that would be hard to do for any of us.
Yeah.
In one way or another, and
yet we managed.
We don't manage so well when we don't breathe. And it's wonderful that you have found that. You know, I wanted, that actually sort of gives a little bit of a lead into something I was going to ask you about later anyway, in a different sort of way. The violin that you're playing presently, you have made a comment that you understood that your life changed as soon as you picked up this violin and you started to play it for the first time, and it, allowing you to breathe differently than you had done with previous instruments. How can that happen? How does that happen?
Well, it's the moment that when I picked up this fiddle, I simply realized that I suddenly was able to do things that I always wanted to, but I didn't have them in my possession. The instruments that I were playing on weren't capable of doing it. The expressive range, the range of colors, even dynamical range, increased by God knows how many percent all of a sudden. Of course, it took time for us to get acquainted and to become friends. I've been playing this violin for 15 years now, and the Stradivari Society, from which this instrument comes to me on loan, these people have become like a second family to me. They gave me this violin, they lent me this violin, pardon me, at the very early stages of my career, and they knew that someone young and promising needs an instrument to be able fully to express him or herself, and they were, I guess, under the impression that I had this potential. So they lent me this fiddle, and they watched me grow with this violin. They were there for my debut in Carnegie Hall. They were there for my debut with Chicago Symphony. All of these moments in life, you know, when a young person goes on stage and says to himself, or, you know, this is the day that I'm going to make it or not. And some, in one shape or form, this organization has become anywhere between really my close friends and to my support team.
And of course, the instrument that they have loaned to you has become as almost as much as part of yourself as yourself.
Well, I really would say so, absolutely. I can't imagine playing any other instrument, frankly. I am capable, of course. If you give me another violin, I will play it. But my perception of violin sound by now has been shaped by this Stradivari violin that I'm playing, and I imagine violin sound as a sound of this violin. So I dare say we have become one by now.
Well, you make a marvelous sound with it, that is for sure, and I wanted to demonstrate that for our listeners with a piece they've probably not heard before. In fact, I had not heard it before I received this recording of yours, which is by a composer named Balys Dvarionas. Where is he from?
He's a Lithuanian composer, a marvelous, fantastic talent, who went to study in Leipzig in the late 30s to the music academy, and he made a mistake, or what I think of a mistake, of coming back to Lithuania, which was already under Soviet rule. And being incredibly nationalistic, in the best meaning of the word, his work was always based and deeply rooted in the national folk music, Lithuanian folk music. That was not encouraged by the Soviet government because the Russian culture was dominating everything, and national cultures were sort of put to the corner, to be in the shade. And his music was never allowed to be performed in the West. He never left Lithuania since he arrived back, and he didn't live a very long life, unfortunately. But he wrote this brilliant concerto, which was played by David Oistrakh. Unfortunately, he never recorded it. And some years ago, when this idea came up of recording Korngold Concerto, which is on the same recording, the conductor, Neeme Järvi, with whom we were making the recording, immediately suggested this concerto, which I have known since my early childhood, growing up in Soviet Union. I knew this piece. And it is a perfect match to Korngold. It is a gorgeous, romantic, incredibly open and exciting piece of music. And I will do everything in my power to promote it and to let people know there is another great concerto out there. In fact, I'm playing it next week in London. So if you're going to play it, I hope your audience is enjoying it.
We just heard a bit of the first movement of the violin concerto by Balis Dvarionas and a performance by Vadim Gluzman, who was performing here with the Resident Orchestra of The Hague, conducted by Naima Yarvi. And he will be playing the Brahms concerto on Friday and Saturday with the Illinois Symphony Orchestra led by Andrew Sewell in Bloomington and Springfield. He's my guest on this portion of Live and Local. And I noted in your biography and also looking at your discography that you've got a fair amount of music that is by people like Dvarionas and others who are less familiar to the average audience goer, including some pieces that are written for you. So you've got a certain dedication to some unfamiliar and also some outright newer music. What's led you to that particular dedication?
Well, I'm curious by nature, and discovering something is a great thrill for me. When you discover an unknown work like the Dvarionas that was just played, it is absolutely extraordinary sensation that you are, if not the first, but you are one of the first people to experience it, and to then have a chance to bring it to the public, of course, is absolutely unbelievable. Then working with living composers, when people write piece for you, it is another sort of a thrill. It is, and I know I might come across as being cocky in a way, but it is almost a feeling of being co-creator. I have worked with a number of leading composers, with some of them I'm very close friends, and just a couple of weeks ago a wonderful American composer, Michael Doherty, whose concerto I've played a number of times, and wrote for me a little piece, a little encore piece for a violin solo called Viva, and he sends me the music in the email. I open it and I have to premiere this piece in a week's time. So I spent this week learning that music, which is absolutely fabulous, fun piece. And this is literally, the ink was still wet when I went on stage a week later in Orange County in California, and I thought to myself, my gosh, this piece didn't even exist 10 days ago, and here I am standing in front of 2,000 people playing it. It is absolutely incredible. It's like you are part of history. You are making history. It's amazing. On top of it, working with today's composers is, I think, the only way of making sure that our art continues as we know it. I mean, imagine if Joachim did not encourage Brahms. We would never have Brahms' violin concerto. And I think it would be a cultural tragedy if this piece didn't exist. If Franz Clement did not encourage Beethoven, we would not have Beethoven's concerto. If Gidon Kremer did not encourage Schnitke and Gubaidulina, the gaps of repertoire would have been unimaginable. So, of course, not every piece that is written is going to survive, and not every piece that is written is a masterpiece. But if we don't try, and if we don't give them a chance to be heard, and let history judge it, and let history decide which one is the next Brahms concerto. If Oistrakh didn't play Shostakovich violin concertos, we would never have this music. Oistrakh had the courage to come out and then play his first concerto 7 years after it was written. It was dangerous to play his music. He still went out and did it. I think it's our duty as a performer to bring new music to the public. And yes, not everything will be liked. Yes, not everything will survive. But once again, this is the only way to find next Brahms concerto.
Well, we're going to go out here in a moment with some music by another composer whose concertos certainly have lasted. And you mentioned to me, actually, before we started, before we opened up the microphone for this conversation, that Max Bruch actually has some relationship to the music of Johannes Brahms.
Of course. Well, these are two composers that were living at the same time in the same country. They had numerous mutual friends, including Mr. Joachim, for whom both Brahms and Bruch wrote their concertos, who premiered both. And Brahms wrote his concerto a bit before, Bruch wrote his concerto a bit before Brahms did. And if you listen to the third movement of Bruch concerto, you will know where Brahms is coming from.
And you just recently recorded his first concerto, probably the most famous of the three. And I think we will play some of that finale. This is a performance with the Bergen Philharmonic. Vadim Glusman is the soloist, of course, who's my guest here on Live and Local. Andrew Litton is conducting. And it's a marvelous-sounding orchestra, marvelous-sounding performance, and, of course, extremely lively at the end. And I appreciate your taking the time to share some of your insights on these pieces with us and also of the whole creation process. And I'm glad that you mentioned Joachim because, as you said, Brahms, the Brahms Concerto, and now this one wouldn't have existed without it. And there, people will find someday down the road that there are certain concertos that have stood the test of time that probably wouldn't have existed without Vadim Glusman, I imagine.
Well, it is my humble hope.
Well, we will look forward to seeing you in Bloomington on Friday and or Springfield on Saturday, depending upon when folks can hear your performance of the Brahms Concerto with the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, Andrew Sewell conducting. Folks can get more information and tickets, or at least information on how to get tickets, at the website ilsymphony.org. And if you'd like more information on Vadim Glusman, including reading his a sort of a blog, your website is?
VadimGlusman.com.
Logically enough. Thanks very much for joining us on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Violinist Vadim Glusman in the final movement of Max Bruch's first violin concerto. He'll be playing Brahms with the Illinois Symphony this weekend in Bloomington and Springfield, Friday and Saturday. You're listening to 90.9 WYNL FM and HD Urbana with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR and Classical Music for Central Illinois. WYNL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois, and we have support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector, too, the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available at thecorkscrew.com. I'm Kevin Kelly. We'll be back with another show tomorrow at noon.